It is always an honor and a privilege to speak for the Palm Valley Church. Every time I come here, I tell you that I get in trouble because of you. So let me tell you the latest. Everywhere I go, I talk about the Palm Valley Church. Just last week, or actually this week, I don't know, this is a couple of days ago, I was speaking at Pepperdine University in Malibu, California, and talking about the Palm Valley Church. There was one church I actually talked about you so much, and the leaders actually pulled me aside and said, "We have heard enough about the Palm Valley Church. I am your traveling evangelist. Talk about you everywhere." Now, tell them to make me a business card saying I'm adjunct staff, okay? Won't you? Let's do this. I appreciate Rick letting me share in this pulpit. I love Gerald and Carissa. They're just, Alice and I have become very close to them. My wife, Alice, is actually here in this service with our daughter, Kimberly. They're sitting back there. And it's Mother's Day. Mother's Day is a day that we typically think of happy, wonderful, exciting things. But if we're going to deal with reality, then we must understand that Mother's Day also can be a very sad day. And let me talk about both sides of that, if I may. You see, mothers are not just those women who have borne children, carried them in their womb, delivered them, suckled them at their breast. I mean, those are mothers, and thank God for that. That's the way that God made the process. But there are mothers in different ways as well. There are some mothers who, for whatever reason, were not able to biologically bear their own children, and so they adopted other children, and they loved those children just as intensely and just as fiercely. There's some who've tried to be mothers, but just for whatever reason, it just did not happen, and so they have gone childless, but not because they intended for it to be that way. There have been some who, as they've gotten older, have mothered more and more people. Like the Old Testament refers to a mother in Israel. It just kind of takes a bunch of people under her wing and takes care of them and ministers to them, makes sure they're all doing well. And because of the world in which we live, there are some women, because I've talked to many of them, I know this is true, who were carrying a child in their womb, and for some reason, fear, pain, guilt, something, decided that they would not carry that child to term. Who later in their life often come to a sense of a great guilt and great pain and wondering what that child would have been like. But they're mothers as well. Now you understand, if you're one of those who believe that, and I am, that life begins at conception, I do believe that, then you would believe that those children do not cease to exist, that those children actually are in heaven. And so even for those mothers, there comes a chance in the future, in the next life, to get to know those children. To apologize, I'm so sorry, but now I look forward to having an eternity to get to know you. And so motherhood covers all kinds of things, including joy and including pain. Would you agree with me that motherhood covers all of that? And so when I talk about motherhood, particularly on Mother's Day, I like to take various mothers out of the Bible and talk to them. And today I've chosen to talk about Mary, the woman who would birth the child, Jesus. Most of their story is in Luke chapter 2, although you find her in the other Gospels as well. You even find her in the book of Acts. But most of the story is in the Gospel of Luke. And you remember that she was visited by the angel Gabriel. By the way, the difference in the angel Gabriel and Michael. Michael typically was a warrior angel. If Michael showed up, it was to do war. If Gabriel showed up, it was typically to give good news. It'd be like us hearing from the Publishers Clearinghouse. So Gabriel would show up, and he told her. And she, by the way, it was not unusual in that culture at that time for women to be betrothed at age 12. Now, not because they were sick people, but because of the fact that those children grew up much faster than ours do. I mean, they were working by the time they were 2 and 3 years old, taking care of the fields and the animals and all those kinds of things. And as their bodies matured, they matured in their minds and hearts much more rapidly. One reason because they didn't live as long, but another because they were giving so much responsibility so young. So it would not be unusual to see a 12-year-old being engaged. So the scholars estimate that Mary was somewhere between 12 and 15 when she was engaged to Joseph. And that's when the angel shows up and says, "You're going to have a child. The Holy Spirit's going to put the child in you." And we got our first glimpse of Mary, that she was a feisty little thing. Now, I'm going to paraphrase, but basically when he said, "You're going to have a child," she said, "I'm a virgin." She was letting him know, hey, don't make it seem like I've done something wrong. I'm a good girl. She's arguing with an angel who's brought her good news. When she finally understands that, she's great. She's excited. Joseph, the man who is engaged to marry her, finds out she is great with child. She's going to have a baby. And so his first thought is to put her away. "I'm not going to marry her." He thought she'd been unfaithful. Then he finds out, no, this is from God. And now the child is about to be born. Now, if you know that the child is about to be born is actually a miracle child, that God put that child in you, then you would expect some kind of unusual things to occur, wouldn't you? I mean, some of you people have birthed children, right? Now, when our first child was born 44 years ago, it was a very civilized thing. They took the woman in that room and the guys all sit in a smoke-filled room. By the time our next child was born, some idiot named Lamaze had come along. And he taught you how to breathe. So Alice and I went to exercises to learn how to breathe. And I'll never forget when one of those intense labor pains hit her, and she was in so much pain, I said, breathe, breathe. And she grabbed this hand and bit me right there. Clamped her teeth down and said, you breathe. And I did. So you think, well, what's going to happen with Mary? Is she going to go through normal childbirth? The answer was yes. No epidural, no anesthesia. It was natural childbirth all the way. She delivers this baby from the time of the garden that has been in pain, so it would be for pain for her as well. And now they've birthed the Son of God. They know this is the child who is God come human flesh. And you, what would you expect him to do? I mean, he's a newborn baby, but he's God. He might look up and go, thanks. I mean, you don't know what the kid's going to do, right? And so they watch and he burps. And then he messes up his diaper, and they go, he's going to be one of us. Well, that's what he chose to be. He chose to be one of us. And so then it come time to dedicate. There was more specific ways they dedicated their babies, but in a way similar to what just happened here. And let's start reading Luke chapter 2 when it was time for them to dedicate the baby. Beginning of verse 25 of Luke chapter 2. Now, there was a man in Jerusalem called Simeon who was righteous and devout. He was waiting for the consolation of Israel, and the Holy Spirit was on him. It had been revealed to him by the Holy Spirit that he would not die before he had seen the Lord's Messiah. Moved by the Spirit, he went into the temple courts. When the parents brought in the child Jesus to do for him what the custom of the law required, I'm just going to skip through the next few verses because basically what happens is he starts giving this wonderful, positive prophecy about what's going to happen in this child's life. And I think any parent would love to hear that, wouldn't you? I mean, remember when you birthed that child and you held that child for the first time in your arms and looked into the child's eyes? And of course, if you're mothers, the first thing you do is count fingers and toes. And then you start looking into the child's eyes and the father looking at the baby thinking, what is this child going to be? Is the child going to be brilliant or average in intelligence? Is the child going to become famous or be a person who just serves people? Is the child going to wind up being president of some country? Or what kind of future might this child have? And you sit there and you wonder and you love the child. And, of course, we tend to think the best. Oh, amazing things are going to happen for this child. And so he gives that prophecy where he talks about all these wonderful things. But he doesn't stop there. In verse 33, the child's father and mother marveled at what was said about him. Then Simeon blessed them and said to Mary, his mother, this child is destined to cause the falling and rising of many in Israel. What he just said was, there are going to be a lot of people who are going to love this child. There are going to be a lot of people who are going to hate your child. I mean, is that the prophecy you want to hear when you hold your baby in your arms, that there will be people who will love your child? Wonderful. There will be people who will hate your child. Really? And to be a sign that will be spoken against. They won't just hate your child. They're going to say terrible and vicious and mean and wicked things about your child. Not because he's that way, but because they're that way. What he says is, so that the thoughts of many hearts will be revealed. What they think about your child reveals more about them. And then she says this, or then he says this to Mary, and a sword will pierce your own soul too. Who would want to hear that prophecy? My child, you said all these wonderful things about God, the Holy Spirit is upon you, so I know it's going to happen. And you tell me these wonderful things, then you tell me that people are going to hate him, and then you tell me that something's going to occur in my life that's going to pierce my soul. Is that what you're telling me? Yes. Now, all of us understand that as we go through life, that life is not perfect. Anybody live long enough to discover that? That life sometimes has pain. Been through that? But would you want God to tell you when you're holding your child in your arms that you're going to have such pain it's going to feel like somebody actually cut through your body into your very soul with a sword? You know, I read one time that people have a greater fear of being cut than they have of being shot. I think it's because we understand more about what a cut feels like a sword. Now, you know she's got to be thinking about this as time goes on. What's that mean? What's going to happen? When is it going to occur? I love this boy, but you go on later into the chapter, and 12 years have passed. He's now 12 years old. We start reading in verse 33. They had gone to this festival in Jerusalem. Now, after the festival was over, while his parents were returning home, the boy Jesus stayed behind in Jerusalem, but they were unaware of it. You see, back then what would happen is when these big groups would travel together, like when they would start back home, the women would leave sometimes up to a day earlier than the men. And then the men would leave and catch up in like 15 minutes. Because the women had stopped at every restroom on the way. And so finally, when the men catch up toward the end of the day and the families are together, they're going to camp, they're going to cook, they're going to eat, et cetera, et cetera. I thought Jesus was with you. No, I thought Jesus was with you. He's 12 years old. He's right on the cusp, you understand. As a 12-year-old, he could be with his mother like with the other children. As a 12-year-old, he could be with his father like a man. And so each thinks he's with the other. And now they realize that this child, this son of theirs, is missing. Now, when I was a young man, understand I was young. When I was a young man and read that, I thought, that would sure make for an awkward prayer. Oh, God, we lost the boy. As I've gotten older and I'm a parent, and I see it in a very different way altogether. I've never lost a child, but one time, just for 2 minutes, one went missing. I was in a very crowded airport terminal. Our daughter Joanna was very young. She was holding my hand. Place was packed with people. We were waiting to pick somebody up. I let go of her hand just for a second to do something, reach back for her hand, and she was gone. I went into sheer terror, thinking, did somebody get her? Did somebody steal my daughter? All those kinds of things. You understand, if you're a parent, the panic that you would feel. Now, it was only 2 or 3 minutes before I found her, but it felt like 2 or 3 centuries of utter panic and pain. So imagine you can't find your son. Verse 44 says, thinking he was in their company, they traveled on for a day. Then they began looking for him and among their relatives and friends. When they did not find him, they went back to Jerusalem to look for him. After 3 days, they found him in the temple courts, sitting among the teachers, listening to them and asking them questions. Everyone who heard him was amazed at his understanding and his answers. When his parents saw him, they were astonished. His mother said to him, "Son, why have you treated us like this? Your father and I have been anxiously searching for you." You think she's mad at him? I mean, from that text, do you think she's mad? Let's put it this way. If you were she, would you have been mad? When I was a Boy Scout, I was part of the original Boy Scouts. We got out of the Ark. I said that too fast. When I was a young Boy Scout, there was a kid who was 12 years old who had run away. And after an hour or two, he wanted to come back home, but by then he was lost in the woods. And so we gathered just everybody we could find to go searching the woods for this kid. We finally found him and brought him back to his mother. I'll always remember the two things that happened in rapid succession when we handed him to his mother. The first thing she did was slap him. And then she hugged him and wept. I think some of us are going to have that happen when we get to heaven. God's going to go, "What were you thinking?" And then give us a hug. It's like, "You scared us. We had all kinds of things." Surely Mary, during those 3 days, was running through her head again and again and again. Is this the sword? It's piercing my very soul. Did you just let me have him for 12 years? Long enough to learn his personality, to see what he was like, to see how he interacted with people. 12 years of standing sometimes at night when he's sleeping and watching him sleep and thinking about how much I love him. 12 years of bonding. Now, of course, the father would as well, but this is the mother's perception. I love him so much. Was that what you intended? Just to give him to me for 12 years? And then take him away and I don't even know where he is. I don't know what's happened to him. I don't know if he's being tortured. I don't know what's occurring. Why? By the way, it's significant that it's 3 days. We'll point to that in a minute or two. But you can understand that, yes, a soul was piercing her sword. A sword was piercing her soul, but you do understand this was not the only time it was going to occur. They didn't always get along with each other. I mean, they really didn't. This particular occasion, she was pretty angry at him. A little bit later, when you get to like John chapter 2, they had gone to a wedding together, and here was Mary and Jesus with his apostles, and they ran out of wine. And so Mary looks at her son and says, they don't have any wine. You do understand that women and men communicate differently, right? Like one guy would say to another guy, I'm hot, turn down the air conditioner. A woman just says, I'm hot, and expects you to interpret that you should turn down the air conditioner. Am I right, guys? So she says they don't have any wine. He knows what she's saying. Make them some. And we have not any recorded miracle before this, yet she knows they can do it. And basically, he gets on to her. Hey, it's not time for me to start. Leave me alone. And rather than answering him, she says to the other guys, get the stuff ready. Why? Because I'm his mama. I wanted to make wine. He will. Anybody else have a mama like that? My mother's 91, and I'm still scared of her. 91 years old. And of course, he made the wine because his mother wanted him to. Time goes on, and Jesus begins to preach, and he starts doing amazing things. He's casting out demons. He's healing the sick. He's actually even raising the dead. He's doing all these amazing things, but his family's not really understanding it, even though you would think that they would. Sometimes we humans can be extremely dense. So we look in the third chapter of Mark, and starting in verse 20, you see this, then Jesus entered a house, and again a crowd gathered so that he and his disciples were not even able to eat. There's so many people there, they can't get to the food. When his family heard about this, they went to take charge of him and said, he's out of his mind. Now, surely you've thought that about some of your family at some point, right? That's my cousin, that's my brother, that's my mother, that's my dad, that's my sister. They're crazy. And that's what they're thinking. He's out of his mind. Now, I don't know exactly why they think that, but they do. Now, they're going to start coming after him. Look at this. And the teachers of the law who came down from Jerusalem said, he's possessed by Beelzebub. What they're saying is, yes, we can't deny that he's doing miracles, but we'll deny that it's by the power of God. The miracles that he's doing must be the power of the devil, Beelzebub. They accuse Jesus of being demonized. Now, you may have at some time heard somebody say something negative about your child, but can you imagine when it starts sweeping through the community and it starts with the religious leaders, the respected people that other people listen to, the people with influence, and they start saying, your kid is a devil. He's wicked. He's mean. He shouldn't even be here. Can you imagine the pain that she would feel just hearing that? And so what does she do? She does what a mama does. She goes to get him. They're talking about you. They're accusing you of things. You come home. But when she and her other sons, the brothers of Jesus, got there, we get to verse 31 now. Then Jesus' mother and brothers arrived. Standing outside, they sent someone in to call him. A crowd was sitting around him, and they told him, your mother and brothers are outside looking for you. Look what he does. Who are my mother and my brothers? Then he looked at those seated in a circle around him and said, here are my mother and brothers. And so now somebody goes back outside to where Mary's standing there with the brothers of Jesus. They come to rescue him because people are treating him so badly, saying all these terrible things about him. They've come to take him home to protect him because that's what mothers want to do. And this guy comes out and says, he's not coming. Oh, he also said that we're his family now. Tell me, mothers, would that pierce your soul with a sword? I've loved you for 30 years now. I've given you my heart. I've been here. I've taken care of you. But they don't always get along with each other. Even Jesus didn't always get along with his mother. That's because we're all imperfect. Now, Jesus was perfect, obviously, but the rest of us are imperfect. Anybody else, as you raised a child, some of you mothers ever had any problems understanding or being understood by your children? Has that ever occurred? My daughter Kimberly, sitting next to my wife Alice, I remember after Kimberly got about 12 or 13, we looked at each other one day and said, a demon has entered our daughter. And Alice and Kimberly fought and fought and fought, and Alice would say, I don't know if we'll ever be friends. Oh, yes, you will. She just has to go through this teenage stuff. And do you think now they get along perfectly? Obviously not, but they're best friends. You mothers understand this, don't you? But if they ever say to you, you're not as important to me as these people are, wouldn't that break your heart? So he keeps preaching, he keeps teaching. He gets to the point where things are going to get really bad. Now, as for it's foreordained by God, he's going to die. It's going to be a terrible death. The night before, he is so terrified by the concept of what's going to happen to him, not just the fact that he's going to die, but the way he's going to die, that he's in the garden and he's begging the Father, please, if there's any other way, please take this cup from me. I don't know what it would be like to lose a child. Some of you do. Some of you have already experienced that, and my heart breaks for you. Several years ago, I was asked to come speak for a group called Compassionate Friends. It's a group of people who try to help each other out. These are people whose children have died. You see, the natural order of things is that the parents die before the children. As much as we miss our parents when they die, we understand that's part of the process. But when our children die before us, the process has been interrupted. It's not the way it's supposed to be. And Compassionate Friends, the way they help them deal with the loss of their children is they don't let them talk in any euphemisms. They don't talk about somebody passing. They use the hard words like, my child was killed by a drunk driver. My child was murdered by a drive-by. My child was killed when he was drinking and drove off the road. And sometimes my daughter killed herself. And these parents all are there trying to help each other understand and to deal with, cope with the fact that this has happened. I mean, watching it in the natural order is tough enough. When my father died, he died at home. All his children and grandchildren gathered around him. If you've ever watched anybody die, you know that they sometimes just stop breathing for several seconds, sometimes up to a minute. And all of a sudden they start breathing again. So you watch. In my family, because I have been in ministry, I was the only one who had actually seen people die. And so anytime my father stopped breathing, my brothers, my sister, my mother would all look at me. And I kept watching that carotid vein in the side of his neck. And as long as it throbbed, even if he wasn't breathing, I knew he was alive. And it stopped. We called the nurse from hospice. She came. She signed the death certificate. They sent the hearse to get my father. It just so happened that the guy driving the hearse, one of the two guys in the hearse, had gone to high school with me. He gets out. He sees me. Joe? Andy. Somebody in your family? My dad. Went into his bedroom. He was sitting in a chair. He had his legs crossed. It had been long enough now that rigor mortis has set in. I literally had to take my father's legs and pull them up. Part where he had crossed them at his ankles, pull them apart so we could get him onto the gurney to take him out to the hearse. I was scared that I was going to break him. I knew my father had gone to heaven, but it's still that body was what he had lived in. Therefore, that body was treasured by us. You understand? This was the only thing of him we had left, though his soul was gone. And as difficult as that was to handle, I don't think it would hold any kind of comparison to having to deal with that with my child. And some of you have experienced that, and I'm so sorry that you have. And imagine it's not just the child dying, but imagine the crowd gathered around who were screaming for the death of Jesus. And then the Romans take him because these people are screaming for his blood, and when they try to find a substitute, well, let us give you this guy instead. No, we want to kill Jesus. And then they take him and they start beating him with that whip. If Mary was not close enough to see, she probably was, but if she wasn't close enough to see, I'll guarantee you she was close enough to hear the lashes hitting his back and the screams of his pain. And I know what a parent would do there, a mother or a father. You'd be doing anything you could to get to that child and to stop this. Don't hurt him anymore. but most of the disciples have run away. She has John, the apostle, with her, and there she is. She's one woman against the Roman army. She can't stop it. And so she listens to the screams of agony of her child and the taunts of the people who wanted him dead. And a sword, again, pierced her soul. As he hung there on the cross, and she's watching him take his last breath, when he's in the kind of pain that we'll never understand, we could understand the pain from a beating, we could understand the pain from nails, we really could, we could understand the splinters, but we could never understand the pain he was in because he was made sin for us. That means he was bearing all the sin of all humanity. You understand the pain that we can't begin to comprehend because we are not God. And in the middle of that pain, you would think all he'd be thinking about was how much it hurt. But in the middle of that, he loved this woman so much that in John chapter 19, as he looked down from the cross, it says, when Jesus saw his mother there and the disciple whom he loved, that's the apostle John, standing nearby, he said, woman, here's your son. And to the disciple, here's your mother. From that time on, this disciple took her into his home. When he was suffering with the pain of the sin of all humanity, he still loved this woman, his mother. And they had conflicted sometimes through life because sometimes you do with your mother. And in the midst of that pain, he makes sure she's taken care of. Mama, you live with John. John? You take care of my mama. Treat her like she's your mama. And then he dies. The disciples were somewhat discouraged. They were expecting Jesus to set up this earthly kingdom. They can't quite understand why he's died. Even though he told them he was going to, they just can't really grasp what had happened here. And for 3 days, oh, by the way, this had happened before, 3 days. The time before, it was 3 days of wondering where he was, who had him, what was going to occur. This time it's 3 days of, I know where his body is. I know what they did to him. I still hear the screams for his blood in my ears. I'm remembering all the way back when Simeon said they were going to do that. And I heard. But the good news is, after 3 days, she found him again, just like last time. This time he resurrected from the dead, never to die again. There's a passage in Acts, chapter 1, verse 14. Let me show it to you as I wrap this up. This talks about what's happening between the resurrection and the ascension of Jesus when all of Jesus' disciples had come together. Look at this. They all joined together constantly in prayer along with the women and Mary, the mother of Jesus, and his brothers. These are the ones who tried to stop him from preaching because people said, you have a demon. These are the ones that didn't understand a lot of what he was doing. These are the ones, at least before the boys were born, when Jesus was the only one, or at least he was the oldest one, when Mary thought, how could you do this to us? You disappeared for 3 days. Don't you care? These are the people who had dealt with him all their lives and sometimes didn't understand him. And now they're his disciples. How about that? Jesus led his mother to him. And now she's a follower. She's disciples. Often in our world, it happens the other way around. It's the mother who leads somebody to Jesus. My older brother, he's 6 years older than I, so he's 115. My older brother didn't become a Christian until he was 54 years old. 54 before he became a Christian. The day they were going to baptize him, and that church baptizes by immersion, but they had a microphone where you could hear, and my brother was in the baptistry, and the minister asked him to repeat his confession of faith so all could hear, do you believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God? My brother said, yes. Then he said to my brother, anything you wish to say? And my brother said, yes, this is because of my mother. She never quit praying for me. She never gave up on me. For all these years, she's lived a godly life in front of me. Not a perfect life. My mom's not perfect. Nobody is. But she lived a godly life in front of me and led me to Jesus. And there are many mothers in this room right now, as well as fathers, who are thinking about one of your children, whether the child is 14 or 44, and you're thinking, can that ever happen for us? I look back to my mother and say, you just keep praying, you just keep living. They may be 54 years old, they may be 94 years old, and you're long gone, but don't ever get up trying to lead your child to Jesus. And then sometimes it happens the other way around. Sometimes it's the children who lead the parents to Jesus. Have you ever seen that? Back when I was actually in ministry with an actual church like this, instead of the ministry I'm in now, we had a 9-year-old young boy who had just become a Christian, who brought his grandmother in and said, I've already taught her, I just want you to check her out. I said, what did you teach her? I taught her that she's a sinner, that she's lost, but that Jesus is the propitiation for her sins. I went, propitiation? So I started asking her questions to make sure she understood, and she said, she did. I said, are you willing to give your life to Jesus? And she said, I do. And so the young man said, I want you to baptize her right now. And I said, fine. So we took her to the baptistry, and I put this frail old woman under the water and thought, you know, this could kill her. But at least she goes straight to heaven. And I'm thinking, because she's just being so peaceful, I think she may be dead already. So I'm afraid to bring her up because they'll know she's dead. But then if I don't bring her up, she's definitely dead. And finally I bring her up, and she was happy, and this grandson, a 9-year-old grandson, led her to Jesus. You see, here's the message of Mother's Day. Mothers are not perfect. Their relationship with their children are not perfect. But if you continue to live the Christian life, moms, Gerald, if you'll start coming up here, please. If you continue to live the Christian life, moms, you have the hope of leading your child to Jesus. If your mom is not with Jesus, or your dad, if you consistently live it, there's always hope up until the end. Now, some of you are going to say, wow, I'm glad we came for Mother's Day. You convinced us our children are going to die. That's right. They are. Until Jesus comes, everybody does. But the good news, mamas, is there's a resurrection.